Is this really what you want? I hissed in her ear. I hate you, she seethed. I hate you all! The endless depth of her hatred extinguished something in me, something I had nursed like a weak ember, the belief that I could go back, could somehow undo these last months. But to her, I was one of them, and that was all I would ever be. One of those who had tied up Leah and forced her to leave the vagabond camp. One of those who had torched her Carvacci and burned out her quiet way of life. Let her go, Rena ordered. She had returned with two buckets of water in her hands. She set them down slowly and looked at me with large, worried eyes, as if I would really slit Natia's throat. She glanced at a poker near the fire pit. I shook my head. Rena, I would never.
What do you want?
She asked. I'm leaving with the outpost troops. I want to see Dahara one last time.
Before she dies, Natia said.
Her tone was sharp with accusation. I pried the knife from her hand and pushed her away. I looked at Rena, trying to find words to convince her I hadn't been part of what had happened to them. But the fact was, I had been. I had lived by the rules of the Komazar, even if I didn't live by them anymore. I had no words to erase my guilt.
Please,
I whispered. Her lips pursed in concentration, weighing her decision. She was still wary. She has good days and bad, she finally said, nodding toward the Carvacci.
She may not know you.
Natia spat on the ground.
If the gods are merciful, she won't.
When I shut the door of her Carvacci, I couldn't see her at first. She folded into the rumpled bedclothes like a threadbare blanket, barely there. In all the years I had known her, she'd either been hoisting a spinning wheel on her back, or butchering a deer, or, if it was late in the season, taking down tent poles and rolling up rugs for the trip south. I'd never seen her like this, or expected to. It had seemed she would outlive us all. Now she looked as fragile as the feathers she once wove into her ornaments.
I'm sorry, Dahara.
She was the oldest member of their tribe, and had fed generations of Ratan, like me, in her camp. I understood Natia's rage. Dahara might have gone on forever, if not for the attack. Her eyes fluttered open as if she had sensed my presence. Her gray eyes stared at the small swelling her feet created beneath the bedclothes, and then her head turned, and she looked at me with surprising clarity.
You,
she said simply. Her voice was weak, but she managed to frown.
I was wondering when you'd come. And the big one?
Grizz was injured. Otherwise he'd be here too. I pulled a stool close to her bed and sat beside her. Natia and Rena weren't happy to see me. They almost didn't let me in. Her chest rose in a labored wheeze.
They're only afraid. They thought they had no enemies, but we all have enemies, eventually.
She squinted.
You still have all your teeth?
I stared at her, thinking she was no longer lucid, but then I remembered Natia's blessing, her send-off to Leah as we left the vagabond camp.
May your horse kick stones in your enemy's teeth.
Dihara's body may have given out, but her mind still held a world of history in it. So far, I answered.
Then you are not the princess's enemy, nor ours.
Her eyes closed, and her words became even fainter.
But now you must decide what you are.
She was asleep again, and I guessed straddling two different worlds, maybe traveling between both, much as I did.
I'm trying,
I whispered, and I kissed her hand, and said goodbye. If I saw her again, I knew it wouldn't be in this world.
Chapter 36. I was told to wait. The king himself would escort me to the caravan. The guards outside my tent were dismissed, which made me suspicious. A trick? Something was not right. Rafe was late, and his tardy minutes seemed like hours. It gave me too much time to think. After our dance at the party, he had disappeared. I saw the shadows swallow him up as his long strides catapulted him through the arched paddock gate to the upper workyard. He never returned, and, strangely, I found myself worrying about him. Where had he gone when this party had been so ridiculously important to him? And then I was angry at myself for worrying, and angrier still when later I was lying in bed and my thoughts drifted to the soft touch of his lips on my cheek. It was madness. I desperately needed something from Rafe that he couldn't give to me. Trust. His lack of faith cut me to the core. His disregard for the future of Morrigan cut me deeper. In spite of what he claimed, Dalbrech and its interests were all that mattered to him. How could he not see that the survival of both kingdoms was at stake? When the party was over, Sven had walked me back to my quarters. He was more reserved than usual, offering me a stiff bow when we reached the door of my tent.
"You do know he has to go back. His kingdom needs him."
"Good night, Sven," I answered curtly. I hadn't wanted to hear any more pleas for Rafe. I wished to hear someone plead for me and Morrigan for once.
"There is something else you should know," he added quickly,
before I disappeared inside. I stopped and frowned, waiting for another petition on Rafe's behalf. He looked down as if embarrassed.
"I was the one who suggested the marriage to the king, and I also planted the enticement of the port."
"You?"
"Along with someone from your kingdom," he hastily added.
He spilled it out in one long breath as though he'd been holding it in for a very long time.
"Years ago, when the prince was 14, I received a letter. Even he doesn't know about it. It came while I was out in the field training cadets, and it had the seal of the kingdom of Morrigan. Needless to say, it caught my attention."
His brows rose as if he'd been caught by surprise all over again.
"I'd never received any missive directly from another kingdom, but it was clear that somehow, someone there knew of my relationship with the prince. It was from the Minister of Archives."
"The royal scholar?"
"Presumably. From his office, at least. The letter proposed a betrothal between the young prince and the Princess Arabella. Effective immediately on our agreement, she would be sent to Dalbrech to be raised in the palace and groomed for her position there. The only stipulation was that the official proposal had to come from Dalbrech. They asked that I destroy the letter. A great deal of money was offered to me if I honored these requests. The whole thing was ludicrous, and I tossed the letter into the fire. I thought it a prank at first, played by my own troops. But the seal had appeared genuine, and I couldn't shake the urgency in it. There was something worrisome in those words that I couldn't quite put my finger on. Still, I ignored the request for weeks. But then when I was back at the palace and alone with the king, I thought of the letter again. Just to get it out of my mind, I threw the idea out. An alliance with Morrigan by way of a betrothal between the young prince and princess. When he balked and dismissed the idea, I added the incentive of the port, which I knew he wanted. I never thought anything would come of it, and the king continued to reject the idea. Until years later."
My mind was already jumping from the content of the letter to who had written it. "Tell me, Sven, do you remember anything about the handwriting?"
"Strangely, I do. It was neat and clear, as I would expect from a minister, but excessive, too."
"The scroll work. It was elaborate?"
"Yes, very,"
he said, squinting his eyes as if he could still see it.
I remember being quite taken with the C in Colonel, written as if to impress me. And it did. Maybe that was it. There was a certain desperation to keep me reading, to play every card at their disposal, even playing to my vanity.
The royal scholar may have sent the letter, but he didn't write it. My mother's handwriting was distinct and impressive, especially when she was trying to make a particular point. How long had the conspiracy to get rid of me been in the making? If Rafe was 14, I was only 12. The very year the Song of Venda seemed to have come into the royal scholar's possession. She will expose the wicked. My stomach turned, and I grabbed a tent pole to steady myself. No. I refused to believe my mother had been conspiring with him all along. It was impossible.
I'm sorry, Your Highness. I know you're set on going back, but I wanted you to know there are people in your own kingdom who have wanted you gone for a very long time. I thought maybe that knowledge would ease your discontent about going to Dalbrek. You'll be welcomed there.
I looked down, still thinking about the long-ago letter, and felt unexpected shame that Sven had to deliver this news to me. Discontent did not begin to describe the range of emotions charging through me.
"We're leaving just after dawn," he added. "Someone will be by to help you gather your things."
"I have no things, Sven. Even the clothes on my back are borrowed. All I have is a saddlebag, which, as wretched as I am, I'm still capable of carrying myself."
"No doubt, Your Highness," he answered,
his tone filled with compassion.
"Nevertheless, someone will be by."
I stared at the saddlebag laid out on my bed now, ready and waiting. It was a wonder that it had survived at all, that I had survived. May the gods gird her with strength, shield her with courage, and may truth be her crown. The prayer my mother had uttered pinched in my throat. Had the prayer helped me survive? Was there any heart behind it for the gods to hear? Or was it a rote verse said by a queen for the sake of those who watched? She had been so distant in those last weeks before the wedding, like someone I didn't even know. Apparently, she had been playing a deceptive role in my life for years. She may have conspired and deceived, but she was also the mother who had laid her skirts out in the meadow for Bryn and me to sit on, and she interpreted the bird song for us, making us laugh at their silly chatter. The mother who shrugged at my shiner when I scuffled with the baker's boy and then tamped down my father's scowl. The mother who told me just before an execution that I could turn away, that I didn't have to look. I wanted to understand who she really was, or what she had become. My eyes blurred, and I longed for that distant meadow and my mother's warm touch again. It was a dangerous thought because it tumbled into more longings, for the laughter of Bryn and Regan, the sound of Aunt Burnett humming, the echoing chimes of the abbey, the aroma of Tuesday buns filling the halls.
"You're ready."
I spun. Rafe was waiting near the door. He was dressed not as an officer, nor as a king, but as a warrior. Black leather pauldrons tipped with metal widened his already broad shoulders, and two swords hung from his sides. His expression was hard and scrutinizing, like that long-ago day when he had first walked into Bertie's tavern. And in the same way it had that day, his gaze took away my breath.
"Expecting trouble?" I asked.
"A soldier is always expecting trouble."
His voice was so controlled and distant, it made me pause for a second look. His dark expression didn't waver. I grabbed my saddlebag from the bed, but he took it from me.
"I'll carry it."
I didn't argue. It sounded like the stubborn declaration of a king rather than a proffered kindness.
We walked through the camp in silence, except for the jingle of his belts and swords, which made his footsteps seem even more ominous. With each step, he seemed larger and more impenetrable. The camp was buzzing with activity, supply wagons rolling toward the gates, soldiers still carrying gear to their horses, officers directing troops to their squad positions in the caravan. I spotted Caden, Tavish, Oren, Jeb, and Sven clustered on their own horses just inside the outpost gates. Two more horses waited beside them, which I assumed were for Rafe and me.
"Find your places in the middle of the caravan," Rafe told them. "I'll help the princess. We'll catch up."
The princess. Rafe wouldn't even say my name. Caden looked at me oddly, a rare flash of worry in his expression, then turned his horse, riding away with the others as ordered. Dread snaked through me. "What's wrong?" I asked.
"Everything."
Rafe's tone remained flat, frighteningly absent of the lively sarcasm he had favored lately. He stayed busy, his back to me, taking an excessive amount of time to strap on my saddlebag. I noted that my horse was heavily laden with supplies and gear.
"My horse is a pack animal?" I asked. "You'll need the supplies."
Another dose of his distant coolness plucked at my ire. "And you?" I asked, looking at his horse, which had none.
"Most of my gear and food will be in the wagons that follow."
He finished with my horse and moved to his own. A sword sheathed in a plain scabbard hung from the pommel of my saddle, and a shield was strapped to the pack behind it. I ran my hand along the horse's soft muzzle. Rafe saw me examining the plain leather noseband.
"None of your tack denotes a kingdom. You can become whoever you choose as the need arises."
I turned, not certain what he was saying. He refused to look at me, checking his own bag and cinch again.
"You're free to go where you wish, Leah. I'm not going to force you to stay with me. Though I would suggest you travel with the caravan for the first 12 miles. At that point, there's a trail that veers west. You can take it if you choose to."
He was letting me go? Was there a catch to this? I couldn't go anywhere without Caden. I didn't know the way. "And Caden is free to go with me as well?" He paused, stone still, staring at his saddle, his jaw clenched tight. He swallowed, but still didn't turn to look at me.
"Free,"
he answered. "Thank you," I whispered, though it didn't seem like the right response at all. I didn't know what to say. Everything about this threw me off.
"Don't thank me," he said. "It might be the worst decision I've ever made. Get up."
He finally turned to me, his voice still cool.
"And you're free to change your mind about leaving any time during those 12 miles.
I nodded, feeling disoriented. The day I had laid out in my head had suddenly vanished and was replaced with a new scenario. I wouldn't be changing my mind, but I wondered why he had changed his. He got up on his horse and waited for me to do the same. I looked at my horse, a fine-boned runner, sturdy but swift like a Morrigie's Ravian. I unsheathed the sword, testing its feel, the cynical tone of Rafe saying "sword play" still ringing in my ears. The sword was of medium weight, well-balanced for my arm and grip. There was no doubt he had chosen every detail of my tack and weapons, from horse to shield. I buckled the sheathed sword to Walther's baldric and swung up on my horse.
"There's one condition I would like to add," Rafe said.
"I knew it."
"I'd ask that you ride beside me, alone, for those 12 miles.
I glanced warily at him. "So you can talk me out of it?" He didn't answer. The caravan set out. Rafe and I rode in the middle with 20 yards between us and the riders ahead and behind, clearly a calculated margin that everyone had been forewarned not to breach. Was it to keep others from overhearing us if our voices should become raised? Surprisingly, he said nothing, and the silence weighed on me like blankets used to sweat out a fever. He stared straight ahead, but even from the side, I could see the storm in his eyes. It was going to be the longest 12 miles of my life. Didn't he think I had doubts and fears about going myself? Damn his stubbornness! Why was he trying to make this even harder for me? I didn't want to die, but neither did I want others to die. Rafe didn't know the Komazar the way I did. Maybe no one did. It wasn't just that he had laid claim to my voice or that his knuckles had slammed across my face. The scent of the Komazar's lust still clung to my skin. His desire for power would not be stopped by a damaged bridge, nor even a knife in his gut. Just as he had warned me, it was not over. After a mile, the silence broke me. "I'll send a note once I'm there," I blurted out. Rafe's eyes remained fixed ahead.
"I don't want any more notes from you."
"Please, Rafe, I don't want to part this way. Try to understand. Lives are at stake."
"Lives are always at stake, Your Highness," he answered, his tone ripe with sarcasm once again.
"For hundreds of years, kingdoms have battled. For hundreds more, battles will be waged. Your going back to Morrigan won't change that." "And likewise, Your Majesty," I snapped back. "Cabinets will always bicker, generals always threaten rebellion, and kings will always prance home all lathered and puckered to appease them." His nostrils flared. I could almost see words blazing in his eyes, but he held them back. After a long silence, I stirred the conversation again. I needed resolution before I was gone, and I'd heard the way he had bandied Your Highness at me, as if it meant just the opposite. "I have a duty too, Rafe. Why should your duty be any more important than mine? Just because you're a king?" A frustrated breath hissed through his teeth.
"It's as good a reason as any of the ones you've offered, Princess."
"Are you mocking me?" I eyed my canteen, remembering it could be useful for more than just drinking. He didn't answer. "A storm brews, Rafe. Not a skirmish or a battle. A war is coming. A war like the kingdoms haven't seen since the devastation." Anger rose off him like heat on a skillet. "And now the Komazar is even able to pluck stars from the heavens. What spell has Venda cast on you, Leah?" This time it was I who didn't answer. I looked away from the canteen, my fingers itching to swing it. We rode on, but he was only successful at being quiet for a short while. When he lashed out, I understood why there was such a great distance between us and the other riders. He abruptly stopped his horse, and I heard a succession of halts and woes behind us, the whole caravan grinding to a sudden stop behind us. His hand slashed through the air. "Do you think I'm not concerned about the Venden army? I'm not blind, Leah. I saw what that small flask of liquid did to the bridge. But my first duty is to Dalbrek and to make sure our own borders are safe, to make right the shambles of my capital, and to make sure I even have a kingdom to go back to. I owe that much to every single citizen there. I owe it to every single soldier riding here with us today, including the ones who helped save your neck." He paused, his eyes fiercely locked on mine. "How can you not understand that?" His scrutiny was desperate and demanding. "I do understand, Rafe," I answered. "That's why I never tried to stop you from going." A reply stalled on his lips, as if I had punched the air from his arguments. Then he angrily snapped his reins to move forward again. He couldn't accept that what was right might also come with a cost to both of us. I heard the creaks and moans of wagons starting to roll again, heard my own heartbeat pounding in my ears. Minutes passed, and I wondered if he was acknowledging the allowance I had afforded him that he couldn't quite give to me. Instead, he uttered another complaint.
"You're allowing a dusty old book to control your destiny."
A book controlling me? Heat shot to my temples. I shifted in my saddle to face him fully.
"Understand this, Your Majesty. There's been a lot of effort to control my life, but it hasn't come from books. Look a little further back. A kingdom that betrothed me to an unknown prince controlled my destiny. A Khomazar who commandeered my voice controlled my destiny. And a young king who would force protection on me thought he would control my destiny. Make no mistake about it, Rafe. I am choosing my destiny now, not a book, nor a man, or a kingdom. If my goals and heart coincide with something in an old, dusty book, so be it. I choose to serve this goal, just as you are free to choose yours.
I lowered my voice and added with cold certainty, "I promise you, King Jackson, if Morrigan falls, Dalbrek will be next, and then every other kingdom on the continent until the Khomazar has consumed them all.
They're only stories, Leah. Myths. You do not have to be the one to do this.
It has to be someone, Rafe. Why not me? Yes, I could turn away and ignore everything in my heart. Leave it to someone else. Maybe hundreds have. But maybe I choose to step forward instead of stepping back.
And how do you explain this?"
I asked, angrily pointing to my shoulder where the kavah still lay beneath my shirt. He looked at me, his expression unmoved.
"The same way you explained it when we first met. It's a mistake. Little more than the marks of grunting barbarians."
I heaved a deliberate, grumbling sigh. He was being impossible.
"You're not even trying to understand." "I don't want to understand, Leah, and I don't want you to believe any of it. I want you to come with me."
"You're asking me to ignore what's happened. Aster took a risk because she wanted a chance for a future for herself and her family. You're asking me to do less than a small child."
"I won't." "Do I need to remind you? Aster is dead."
He may as well have added, "because of you." It was the cruelest blow he could have dealt to me. I was unable to speak. He looked down, his mouth pulled in a grimace.
"Let's just ride and not talk before we both say something we'll regret."
My eyes burned with misery. It was already too late for that. The sun was high, midday, and I knew we had to be getting close to the point where Caden and I would leave the caravan. Whatever landscape we passed, I saw none of it. My insides were raw, shredded from one end to the other by someone who I had thought loved me. Yes, it was the longest 12 miles of my life. Orin, Jeb, and Tavish rode ahead, and when they pulled out of the caravan, for the first time I noticed that their horses were as heavily laden with supplies as mine was. They stopped about 30 yards away between two low knolls. Caden joined them, waiting. And that's when I understood. They were coming with us. I couldn't bring myself to tell Rafe thank you. I wasn't even sure if their added presence was protection or a trick. He motioned for me to pull off the trail, and we stopped halfway between Caden and the caravan. We both sat there waiting for the other to speak, seconds stretching as far as the horizon.
"This is it," he finally said.
His tone was subdued, weary, as if all the fight was gone out of him.
After all we've been through, this is where we part ways?
I nodded, meeting his stare with silence.
You choose a duty you once scorned over me?
I could turn that right back on you, I answered quietly. The blue of his eyes grew deeper, like a bottomless sea, and they threatened to swallow me whole.
I never scorned my duty, Leah. I came to Morrigan to marry you. I sacrificed everything for you. I put my own kingdom at risk for you.
The bloody furrow inside me tore wider. What he said was true. He had risked everything. Is that my debt to you, Rafe? Do I have to give up all that I am and everything I believe in to pay you back? Is that really who you want me to be? His eyes locked on mine, and it seemed there was no air left in the universe. Time stretched impossibly, and he finally looked away. He eyed my pack and weapons, the sword, the knife at my side, the shield, all the supplies he himself had carefully selected. He shook his head as if it wasn't enough. His attention turned toward the waiting trio.
I will not risk their lives again by sending them into a hostile kingdom. Their only duty is to escort you safely back to your border. After that, Dalbrek is done with Morrigan. Your fate will be in your own kingdom's hands, not mine.
His horse stamped as if sensing his frustration, and Rafe cast one last look at Caden. He turned back to me, the anger drained from his face.
You've made your choice. It's for the best, then. We are each called somewhere else.
My stomach turned queasy, and a sick, salty taste filled my mouth. I felt him letting go. This was it. I forced myself to nod. For the best.
Goodbye, Leah. I wish you well.
He turned his horse before I could even offer my own last farewell, riding off without so much as a backward glance. I watched him go, his hair blowing in the wind, the shine of his swords glinting in the sun, and a memory flashed in my mind. My dreams rushed back, large and crushing like a wave, the dream I'd had so many times back at the sanctum, a confirmation of the knowing that I didn't welcome. Rafe was leaving me. Every detail I had dreamed was now laid out before my eyes, stark and clear. The cold, wide sky, Rafe sitting tall on his horse, a fierce warrior dressed in garb I had never seen before. The warrior dress of a Dalbrek soldier with a sword at each side. But this wasn't a dream. I wish you well. The distant words of an acquaintance. A diplomat. A king. And then I lost sight of him somewhere near the front of the caravan, where a king should ride.
Chapter 37.
We rode hard. I focused on the sky, the hills, the rocks, the trees. I scanned the horizon, the shadows, always watching. I planned. I devised. No moment was left without purpose. No moment left for my mind to steep in dangerous thoughts that would consume me. What if... Doubt was a poison I couldn't afford to sip. I rode faster, and the others worked to keep up. The next day, I did the same. I said my remembrances morning and evening without fail, remembering Morrigan's journey, remembering Gaudrell and Venda, remembering the voices in the valley where I had buried my brother. Every memory was another bead on a necklace strung somewhere inside me. I fingered them, squeezed them, held them, polished them bright and warm.
They were the real and true. They had to be. And when fatigue washed over me, I remembered more. The easy things. The things that could pull another mile, another 10 out of me and my horse. My brother's face, desolate and weeping as he told me about Greta. The shine of Aster's lifeless eyes. The traitorous grins of the scholars in the caverns. The Komazar's promise that it wasn't over. The endless games of courts and kingdoms that traded lives for power. Each bead of memory that I added helped me move forward. On the first night, when I had unloaded the pack on my horse, the necklace of carefully polished beads suddenly snapped and spilled to the ground. It was the simplest of things that broke it loose. An extra blanket tucked inside the bedroll. A change of riding clothes. An additional belt and knife. They were only the basics for a long journey, but I saw Rafe's hand behind it all, the way he folded a blanket, the knots he made to secure it. He had chosen and packed each piece himself. And then his last words struck me. Cruel words. Aster is dead. Words that piled on guilt. I sacrificed everything for you. Parting words. It's for the best. I had clutched my stomach, and Caden was immediately at my side. Jeb, Oren, and Tavish stopped what they were doing and stared at me. I claimed it was only a cramp, and I willed the pain twisting in me into a small, hard bead and knotted my resolve with it. It wouldn't undo me again. Caden reached out. Leah, I shook him loose. It's nothing. I ran down to the creek and washed my face. Washed my arms, my neck. Washed until my skin shivered with cold. What I left behind would not jeopardize what lay ahead. Over the next few days, Jeb, Oren, and Tavish regarded me carefully. I guessed they were not comfortable with their quest. Before, they had been leading me away from danger, and now they were depositing me on its doorstep. In the early evening, when there was still light, I practiced with knife and sword, axe and arrow, not knowing when or where I might need any of them. Since it was his specialty, I enlisted Jeb to teach me the silent art of breaking a neck, and he reluctantly agreed, then showed me more methods to dispatch an enemy without a weapon, though many of those methods were not exactly silent. Later, when it was dark and there was nothing left to do but sleep, I listened for the sounds of the rattan, howls, footsteps, the sliding of a knife from a sheath. I slept with my dagger on one side of my bedroll and my sword on the other, ready. There was always a thought, a task, another bead to polish and add to my string. And then when there was only silence, I would wait for the veil of darkness to overtake me. The one thing I couldn't control were my moments of restless half-sleep, when I rolled over and my arms searched for the warmth of a chest that was no longer there, or my head tried to nestle in the crook of a shoulder that was gone. In that nether world, I heard words trailing behind me, like wolves stalking their prey, waiting for it to weaken and drop, strings of words that would pounce. How can you not understand? And, maybe worse, the bite of words that were never said.
Chapter 38, Caden.
I knew she was hurting. It had been 3 days. I wanted to hold her, make her stop, slow down. I wanted her to look into my eyes and answer a question I was too afraid to ask. But trying to make Leah do anything right now was the wrong course of action. On the first day when she had joined us on the trail and Tavish had asked if she was all right, I had watched her turn to stone. She knew what Tavish was implying, that she was weak or wounded by Rafe's departure. Your king is where he should be, tending to the needs of his kingdom, and I'm doing what I need to do. It's as simple as that. I know he made promises to you about Terevin. She hadn't answered him. She'd only looked back at the disappearing caravan and tugged on her gloves, flexing and shoving her fingers deeper into them, and said, "Let's ride." Rafe's expression on that last night, when he threw me up against the barracks wall, stayed with me. He had been wild with fear, afraid to let her go, but he did. Something I hadn't done, no matter how many times she'd asked me to free her as we crossed the Camlan Tow. The thought turned in my head over and over again. We were camped in a thin scrabble of beach, tucked up close to an outcropping of boulders. A shallow brook ran close by. Leah sat off by herself, but not too far from the camp. We all still looked over our shoulders and slept with our weapons ready. We knew there could be more out there. Eben's account of who he had seen leave the sanctum, while helpful, could not include who he might not have seen. I knew what would come next. Once she finished her remembrances, she would sharpen her knives, check her horse's hooves for stones, scan the trail behind us, or scratch in the soil with a stick, then erase the marks with her boot. I wondered what she drew. Words? Maps? But when I asked her, she only said, "Nothing." I had thought this was all I ever wanted, to be with her, on the same side. She's with you, Caden. That's all that matters.
I'm going to start dinner, Orin said,
casting a wondering glance Leah's way. He walked over to the firewood I had gathered and set his spit, spearing the pheasant he'd already gutted and cleaned. Tavish returned from washing up in the brook. His thick black ropes of hair dripped with water. He followed my gaze, looking at Leah, and offered a quiet grunt. I wonder what drill she'll put one of us through tonight.
She wants to be prepared.
One person alone can't take on an entire kingdom.
She has us. She's not alone.
She has you, and that's not saying a lot. The rest of us turn around once we reach the Morrigie's border.
He shook out his hair and pulled his shirt over his head.
The first few days riding with Rafe's loyal trio had been tense, but for Leah's sake I held back my tongue, and a few times my fist, too. Now they seemed to accept that I wasn't along to whisk Leah back to Venda, and that I had retired my former title of assassin, at least until Leah was back in Morrigan. Whether I wanted to admit it or not, they were useful, too. I knew hundreds of trails along this southern route, but every rattan knew them, too. These three had surprised me with a few trails that wound through hidden box canyons where I had never traveled before. And with Orin along, we never had to eat snake. He was able to draw an arrow and bring down game from his saddle while barely slowing his pace. His skill and passion were perfectly matched.
"Have you noticed?" Tavish asked as he shook out his saddle blanket and hung it over a low branch. "Every dusk when she says her remembrances, the wind stirs?"
I had noticed, and wondered. The air seemed to thicken and come alive as if she were summoning spirits.
"Could just be the natural shift of air as the sun goes down."
Tavish's eyes narrowed.
"Could be."
"I didn't think you Dalbrech were the superstitious sort."
"I saw it back at the sanctum, too. I was there watching from the shadows, and I heard everything she said. Sometimes it felt like her words were touching my skin, like the breeze was carrying every single one past me. It was a strange thing."
I had never heard Tavish ruminate on anything beyond trails and suspicions of my true motivations, which had almost brought us to blows.
He blinked as if catching himself.
"My watch," he said, walking away to relieve Jeb.
He stopped after a few steps and turned.
"Just curious. Is it true you used to be Moragese?"
I nodded. "That's where you got all the scars? Not in Venda?" "A very long time ago." He eyed me as if trying to figure out how old I must have been. "I was 8 the first time I was whipped," I said. "The beatings lasted for a couple of years until I was taken to Venda. It was the Komisar who saved me."
"Being the fine fellow that he is?"
He studied me, chewing the corner of his lip. This revelation probably didn't improve his regard for me.
"Those are deep scars. I'm guessing you remember every lash. And now you suddenly want to help Morgan?"
I leaned back on my elbows and smiled.
"Always suspicious, aren't you?"
He shrugged.
"Tactician, it's my job."
"Tell you what, I'll answer your question if you'll answer one of mine." His chin dipped in agreement, waiting for my question. "Why are you really here? Your king could have sent any squad to escort the princess to the border of her kingdom. Why his top officers? Was it only so you could escort her back to Dalbrek once she came to her senses? And if she didn't, to force her back?" Tavish smiled.
"Your answer isn't so important to me after all," he said, and left.
As Tavish walked away, I watched Leah stride toward me, with dusty riding leathers and a smudged face. 3 weapons hung from her sides, and she looked more like a soldier than a princess, though, in truth, I wasn't even sure what a princess should look like. She had never fit any image I had conjured of one. Royal. How easily I had disparaged the title, when the only nobility I had ever really known was my father, the esteemed Lord Rocher of County Dewar. His line went all the way back to Piers, one of the first holy guardians, affording him an elevated status and special favor among nobility, if not the gods themselves. My mother had told me of my ancestry once. I had worked hard to forget it and prayed I had gotten all of her blood and none of his. Leah paused, lifting Walther's baldric over her head, and laid it down on her bedroll, then unbuckled her other belt that held 2 knives, dropping it with the rest of her gear. She stretched her arms overhead as if she was working a knot loose in her back, then surprised me by plopping down beside me. She gazed across the hills and woods that obscured the horizon and setting sun, as if she could see all the miles that still lay ahead of us. "No knives to sharpen?" I asked. Her cheek dimpled. "Not tonight," she said, still gazing out at the hills. "I need to rest. We can't keep this pace up, or the horses will give out before we do." I looked at her skeptically. Jeb and I had said almost those exact same words to her this morning, and she had only answered us both with a scathing look of contempt. "What's changed since this morning?" She shrugged. "Pauline and I were terrified when we rode from Civica, but eventually we stopped looking over our shoulders and started looking for the Blue Bay of Terevin. That's what I need to do now. Only look forward." "It's that simple?" She stared through the trees, her eyes clouded in thought.
"Nothing is ever simple," she finally said. "But I have no other choice. Lives depend on it."
She shifted on the blanket and faced me fully.
"Which is why we need to talk."
She shot questions at me, one after another, a methodical urgency to them. Now I knew at least some of what occupied her thoughts as she rode. I confirmed her suspicion that the Komisar would begin marching after first thaw. As I doled out answers, I realized how little I actually had to give her. It made me see that, for all of my conspiring with the Komisar, he had kept me in the dark more than he had confided in me.
I had never been a true partner in this plan of his, only one of many to help him accomplish it. There must be other traitors besides the Chancellor and Royal Scholar. Didn't you deliver any other messages?
I only delivered the one message when I was 13. He mostly kept me out of Civica altogether. I tracked down deserters, or he sent me to deliver retribution to outlying garrisons. She chewed on her lip for a moment, then asked me something odd. She wanted to know if we would pass any place where messages could be sent.
Turquoise Traw. There's a relay post of messengers there. They're fast, but costly.
Why? I asked.
I might want to write home.
I thought you said the Chancellor would intercept all messages.
A fierce glint shone in her eyes. Yes, he will.
Chapter 39.
On the fourth day, we hadn't gotten far when Caden said, "We have company."
"I saw," I answered sharply.
"What do you want to do?" Tavish asked. I kept my eyes straight ahead.
"Nothing. Just keep going."
"She's waiting for an invitation," Jeb said.
"She's not going to get one," I snapped. "I told her she couldn't come. She'll turn around."
Oren smacked his lips. "If she made it through three nights alone, I doubt she'll give up that easily."
I growled with all the fury of Grizz and snapped my reins, turning my horse around to gallop back toward Natia. She stopped her horse when she saw me coming. I came alongside her.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Riding," she said defiantly.
"This is no holiday, Natia. Turn around. You can't come with me."
"I can go where I want, and it just happens to be in the same direction I'm going?" She shrugged. Her audacity appalled me.
"Did you steal that horse?" I asked, trying to shame her.
"It's mine."
"And Rena said you could come?"
"She knew she couldn't stop me."
She was not the same girl I had met in the vagabond camp. I hated what I saw in her expression. Her cheerful innocence was gone and replaced with alarming hunger. She wanted more than I could give her. I needed her to go back.
"If you come along, you're probably going to die," I told her.
"I heard you're going to do the same. Why didn't that stop you?"
Her eyes were clever and sharp like Aster's, and I looked away.
I couldn't do this. I wanted to strike her, shake her, and make her see how very much she was not welcome here.
Caden rode over. "Hello, Natia," he said, and nodded like we were all out for a spring ride.
"Oh, for the love of gods, tell her she has to go back. Make her listen."
He smiled. "The way you listen." I looked back at Natia, a bitter gall climbing up my throat. She met my stare, unblinking, her decision shining in her eyes. Moisture sprang to my face, and I was afraid I might lose my morning meal. She was so young, almost as young as Aster, and far more naive. What if... I wiped the sweat from my upper lip.
"Come along," I snapped, "and keep up. We aren't going to coddle you."
Journey's End. The promise. The hope. Is this the place of staying, Amma? A vale. A meadow. A home. A scrabble of ruins we can piece together. A place far from the scavengers. The child looks at me, her eyes full of hope, waiting. For now, I tell her. The children scatter. There is laughter, chatter. There is hope. But there is still no promise. Some things will never be as before. Some things you cannot bring back. Some things are gone forever, and other things last just as long. Like the scavengers, one day they will come for us again. The Last Testaments of Gaudrell. Chapter 40, Rafe.
The sun. Had I mentioned the sun? Maneuver your opponent so the sun is in his eyes, not yours. Dodge and undercut. I hadn't gone over that. But it wasn't as if she didn't already have good sword-fighting skills. Maybe I should have given her a lighter sword. There were so many things I could have said, and not just about swords. I knew I was second-guessing myself. I had been for most of the journey. Your Majesty, we're almost there. I've been talking for 20 minutes, and you haven't heard a word I said. I heard you say it yesterday, Sven, and the day before. Kings do this, they don't say that. They listen, they weigh, they act. They take, but they give. They push, but aren't pushed. Does that sum it up? You're acting as if I didn't grow up in court. You didn't, he reminded me. I frowned. For the most part, he was right. Yes, I'd had weekly meals with my parents, and I was included as a matter of protocol in most official functions. But for the many years I was under Sven's tutelage, I had lived with cadets, pledges, and most recently, with other soldiers. Dalbrecht's kings were soldiers first, and I had been raised no differently from how my own father had been raised. But in the last year, he had been pulling me closer into the fold. He had me sit in on high-level meetings and counseled me on them afterward. I wondered if he had seen his reign coming to an end. "We're still a good 10 miles out," I said. "I'm ready, I promise you." "Maybe," he begrudged me, "but your mind is elsewhere." My hands tightened on my reins. I knew he wouldn't let this go. "You did what you had to do," he went on. "Letting her go was an act of courage. Or stupidity. She's on her way to a kingdom riddled with traitors who want her dead," I finally blurted out. "Then why did you let her go?" I didn't answer. He knew. He'd already said it. Because I had no choice. And that was the biting irony. If I had forced her back to Dalbrecht, I'd have lost Leah just the same. But as long as Sven had opened the door to what occupied my mind, I ventured further, asking a question that had circled in my head like a mad crow pecking at my flesh. "I know the assassin loves her," I swallowed, then added more quietly, "Do you think she loves him?" Sven coughed and shifted in his saddle. He grimaced. "That's not my area of expertise. I can't advise you on..." "I'm not asking for advice, Sven. Just your opinion. You seem to have one on everything else." If he had knocked me off my saddle, it would have been within his rights. And it wouldn't have been the first time. Instead, he cleared his throat. "Very well. From what I observed at the sanctum, and the way she interceded on his behalf when we captured him, I would say, yes, she does care for him. But love? Of that I'm not so sure. The way she looked at you was..." A trumpet sounded. "Troops!" the flag-bearer called. We were too far out to be greeted by a squad yet, but when Sven and I pushed our horses forward for a better view, there it was. Not just a squad, but what looked like a whole Dalbrecht regiment heading our way. Double the numbers in our caravan. To stop us or escort us in? It was not customary for outpost caravans to be greeted this way. But then challenged kings were not usually part of a returning caravan. "Arms ready," I called. The order rolled back along the caravan like a war chant. "Move forward." As we got closer, Captain Azia shouted more orders, and the caravan spread out, creating a wide, formidable line. Shields were raised. We were facing our own. Not exactly how I had envisioned beginning my reign. The kingdom was more divided than I'd thought.